I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the Nokomoto Motorcycle Podcast, episode number 203, I'm pretty sure.
No, you said 203 last time.
Oh, well, so that makes it 204, I would suppose. We are coming to you from northern Colorado, where we got another one of our beautiful 300 days of sunshine that we get every year. Coming to you from my basement, also known as Moto One Podcast Network Studios, recording suite A. And we have some special announcements at the top of this show. I put up a post about this on Patreon. Swiggy and I discussed it. And we are going to aggressively undercut the competition. All right? You remember that Tom Green sketch, Undercutter's Pizza?
How could I forget?
This is going to be exactly like that. Exactly like that, Swigs. There's another podcast, who will rename nameless, that has introduced a special $25 a month tier level where they let you be a guest on the show. I'm going to open it up to all Patreon members of our show can be a guest on our show. We've only had listeners be guests a couple times, but we've had extremely positive results every single time. I'm going to open this up. I'm going to make it the $5 level. $5 and up, you know? So this is what you do if you want to join the Patreon. I'm not going to list this as an official benefit because I don't want to get into something where we're required to do it every week. But if you feel that what I'll start doing is as soon as we're going to record on different days every week, as soon as I know what our recording time is, I will put that out on the Patreon. I will say, hey, we're recording at roughly this time. Can you be available? And whoever can be available, just send us a message on Patreon. Let us know. And we'll let you know at least the day beforehand or something. You know, hey, yeah, you got it. Go on. This is all you need to do. You need to have a microphone, which is not your fucking laptop built-in microphone.
Or your cell phone.
I don't care if it's a gaming headset. A gaming headset is fine. You just need some sort of microphone that's an actual, like, legitimate separate microphone and a quiet space. That's all we require. Some microphone that you can plug into your computer and a quiet space. We'll take care of the rest. All we will do is send you an email link to an online sort of virtual recording studio room. All you'll have to do is click it from your email, and that's it. It's very, very simple, but your room has to be quiet. That's all we ask. You can bring nothing else to the table. You can have zero personality. You can have zero jokes. You can have zero opinions. I don't care. You're a Patreon member. You're welcome to be here with us virtually. I just need you to at least go to Walmart and spend $25 on the cheapest gaming headset that they have. You do need headphones as well. But I assume you can at least grab a pair of earbuds or something to plug into your computer. But the Walmart $25 gaming headset, we'll get it done. I just need a fucking quiet room from you. That's it. And you have to be a Patreon member. And that's it. Yeah. If multiple people can do it, I will draw a name out of a hat. We will make it very, very obvious. And then if you're the runner up, then you'll automatically be the next one to be on the show. It's very simple. We can be adults. We can keep it easy, but here you go. That's it. You're a Patreon member. Boom. You can be a part of the show. That's it. I'm pretty excited about it, honestly, because I've been wanting to do more with the Patreon for a while. And I was like, I don't know. There's stickers, there's mugs, there's, you know, there's stuff. There's the ability to message us and things, but it's like, people send emails anyway. Like, what can we really do that's, And I was like, oh yeah, that's what everyone wants. They just want to be on the show, of course. I don't know why it took me so fucking long to realize.
Well, because most other people for Patreon do like exclusive content. And it's things that would normally go on like Instagram or TikTok.
But yeah, we just give everybody all the content we have anyway.
Yeah. And
ad nauseum.
Yeah. And, you know, every time we went to Coda, it was always like, oh, I could have pulled my phone out and recorded something that was happening, but I will never have that instinct.
Me neither. We were not born for social media.
I think if you take all the photos I've taken over like the last 5 years on my phone, 80% of them are dog pictures from the last 3 months.
And all the rest are motorcycles you've bought.
Yeah.
That's it. There's no nieces or nephews. There's no. There's no Christmas photos. Yeah. But I think this is the great direction for our Patreon. Okay. So it's basically, hey, how much do you want to give? Do you want like the extra sticker and mug and whatever else that comes with whatever else? But you don't even need to be a top tier Patreon member at this point. Just $5 and up, boom, you're in the running.
I will say you should.
Maybe if we get to some sort of situation where it's a tie between a $5 and a $15 member, I think we're going to lean towards the $15 member. But outside of that, no, you just sign up for at least $5 a month. Boom. You can be on the show.
Yeah. I will say you don't have to bring something, but if you do have an interesting topic.
Well, we're going to ask you about your bike history. We're going to ask you, you know, where you live, where you ride, you know, those sorts of things. You're going to get the standard questions. You're going to get a lot of the same questions Eric fucking Buell got. All right. But I don't know. That's just that. Okay. What else in news? We're still on for the Coda trip. At this point, it's looking like we're instead of driving down and taking mini bikes, there's a very good chance that we're just doing the 1,000-mile ride down there again. So anyone between Colorado and Austin, Texas, anyone between Denver and Texas, basically, if you want to join the ride, let us know. You can meet up with us and tag along, whether you're in an RV or on a motorcycle, or I mean, as long as you're on a skateboard or running. I think, you know, we'll find a way. And la, 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 what else? I know there's other news items, the things for the top of the show, but I can't remember what they are. I think that's enough babbling. I think we should get into the show. So, best worst bike in the world this week. What do you think, Swigs?
Let's do it.
Okay, so here we go. I know we've got some new listeners because we've been running ads on Buzzsprout. So here we go. This is Best Worst Bike in the World this week. This is our signature segment. This is the bit where Swigs and I have each chosen a motorcycle. We don't know what each other have chosen. It's always a surprise. Remember, your feelings might get hurt. It's really just a fun way to look at two motorcycles in a way that you might not normally look at them. And remember, there's no crying in motorcycles. If you choose to take exception or have something to add to the conversation, make sure before you send us an email to contact@nokomotopodcast.com, you leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the podcatcher of your choice. If you don't do that, shame on you. There's a special place in hell for you, and I hope that you only ever own unreliable Chinese pieces of shit motorcycles. Now, Swigs, you have worst bike in the world this week?
I do.
And are you ready to reveal it?
No, because I'm on the wrong network.
I'll just sip a beer really loudly into the microphone while you do that. So every second people have to listen to this, it's your fault. Are you on the right network now?
I am.
Excellent. Okay. Hold on. Now everyone has to hold this is a new rule. While the drum roll plays, you have to hold your breath. And the worst bike in the world this week is?
The Bajaj Platina 100.
No, you know, I kind of like the look of it immediately. I want to own one, but I'm sure it's horrible.
Okay, so the theme of of this bike, and the reason I chose it is it's current year. It's 2023, and there are some things that even the third world must let die.
Well, I wouldn't even call India third world anymore.
I guess technically it is first world. It was a colony.
This is a place where you can buy CBR 650Rs.
We'll get to that. Okay. Oh. So, the Bajaj Platina 100. This is a 2023 release. This is a 100cc single.
No problem with that.
7.8 horsepower.
That's actually good for a 100cc four-stroke. Okay.
6 foot-pounds of torque.
That's a little low. Okay.
Drum brakes front and rear.
I need to know the weight to make a ruling on that.
It's 250 pounds.
You can get away with the drum brakes. I don't like it, but I'm going to need to know price to make an ultimate ruling.
Well, this is where it gets a little bit tricky, but when we look at other bikes, you can see that this is not
Yeah, we need the market comparison, because this is a market we're not familiar
with. So, the MSRP or equivalent in India is about 65,000 rupees, which is about $800.
This is still carbureted, right?
No, this weirdly is fuel injection.
Okay, that's what I thought, because looking at the exhaust, it looks like there is just the teeniest, tiniest little catalytic converter with an O2 sensor that I've ever seen in my life.
I will also say I spent a long time looking for some better pictures of this bike, and no, this is like a 260p photo, and it's the highest res I could find.
Right, but you see, do you see where I'm looking at it?
Yeah,
like there's a tiny little cat with an O2 sensor just coming off the side of that pipe there.
There is a pixel that suggests. And There may be an O2 sensor in there.
I think that is what's happening here. I think all the extra money that would have gone into a little disc brake and the money that would have gone into an electric starter has gone into a cat, an O2 sensor, and fuel injection system on this. And the rest of the bike has been put back a decade as a result because it still has to hit the Indian market price point. That's my initial theory here. Let's dig in more and see if we're correct.
Well, the biggest problem here is that the imported Yamaha. So we haven't gone over this for a long time, but there is a big issue with getting, you know, kind of big four bikes into India, which is.
Oh, it's all tariff. It's like Brazilian-style tariffs. It's Trump-slash-Brazil-style tariffs.
It's like, it's ludicrous from like 50 to like 200% import tariffs on things brought into
India. This is why you can't really buy a Honda in India. You have to buy a Hero Honda.
Right, yeah. You have to buy, everyone has to kind of partner with another local company.
It has to at least be a joint venture. Yeah.
Right. But you can buy like 125s and 250 dirt bikes for double the cost of this.
Huh.
You can buy like functional bikes. Even looking at like what is it? Let me just find one here real quick. Like
you're saying twice the money gets you three times as much.
Yes.
Like it's diminishing returns with how much more money you spend. This is diminishing returns with how little you spend.
Yeah. Like imagine if you were like, "Oh, I could buy like a cut market Z650 for like half the price, but it has 15 horsepower."
Right.
You'd be like, well, that's dumb. That makes no sense whatsoever. This is, you know how like when you go to the movie theater, you can buy like a small popcorn for $10, but then there's a medium for $11 and a large for $14.
Right.
And the large is like 8 times the size of the small. So you're like, well, we might as well get the large. And, you know, the other two are false options that nobody would ever buy, but they put them there to convince you that the large is a good value.
Yeah.
This is the equivalent of like having a reasonable middle option and then saying, would you like a quarter of the value for 95% of the price?
Right.
Like that's what is going on here.
I've already forgotten who's making this again.
Bajaj.
Oh, okay. That's less surprise. Okay. All right. Bizarre. I don't have a great grip on Bajaj. I have a bit of a grip on Bajaj as far as their sort of Vespa related patent knockoff bikes. But outside of that, I don't really have a great grip on the company. This screams India to me. It's okay. You know, 7 horsepower is enough in India. Now I know you're going to say, well, Pete, like a Honda 70 will get you 7 horsepower. And yes, you're right. But, you know, when you're making it in India and you're making it in some remote areas and you're making it in places where supply isn't what it is in other parts of the world, and you're going for this cheap, I can give 100 cc's 7 horsepower and I'm totally okay. An air-cooled 100 cc 4-stroke, I will forgive at 7 horsepower. This is plenty fast enough for any part of Mumbai that you're in.
Yes, but the thing for me is...
Is this enough for the United States? Fuck no! But
I can't imagine, with just a modest investment in 2023, that you can't mill some disc brakes...
Yeah, the brakes are something. Now again, like the engine is fine at 100 cc's. This is what people are expecting. But are people in India at this point expecting a disc front brake? Well, they might be starting to expect that on some models. But again, this is fuel injected, which is still not the norm, right? It's only just starting to turn that way. India is doing what Harley Davidson did in 2007.
I was going to go there. Yeah, this is and this is as embarrassingly behind the times as Harley Davidson has been.
And
for
it's
a while.
Only starting to happen because tooling is switching over, part supplies are switching over. That in some cases it's becoming cheaper and easier to do fuel injection than it is carburetors.
Well, yeah, look.
But if you're going to do fuel injection, you need an O2 sensor. And if you're going to have an O2 sensor, you might as well, like, be... It's not that hard to put the cat in there and start having some emissions. And if there's a place in the world that could do with a little bit of cleaner air, trust me, it's Mumbai.
It's just a question of, like... You know, at this point, it must... I would have thought that by now... We were getting to the point where, like, finding tooling and finding people investing in, like, the manufacturing of drum brakes, like, it should be a problem to find them, not an economy option anymore.
Oh, Swigs, I forgot.
This is like trying to find like rope lighters.
Look, I have to derail this conversation for a second, and I'm really sorry. We are going to get back to this bike. I forgot to tell all the listeners the reason that I already sound like I'm 5 beers in. We discovered that there's a Natterday's vodka.
Oh, yeah, we did.
And I had several Natterdays and club soda before this podcast started. Listeners, do yourself a favor. It's basically the Natterdays popsicles, but melted. and then you add club soda. And this is I think this is going to be the show's signature cocktail. You know how Cleveland Motos reel into the painkillers, which is a delightful drink that me and Claire make on a regular basis. The Natterday's vodka and club soda, we need a name for this cocktail. And I want to put it out to the listeners. What do you think? I need a name for this for Natterday's and club soda. Natterday's vodka and club soda. Cause it tastes like Natterday's, but it's like 60 proof. It's basically 60 proof Natterday's and it's pink in color. Anyway, just putting it out there before I forget that this is important, Swigs. Okay. Don't tell me it isn't. All right. Back to this bike. What was this bike called again?
The Platina 100.
The Platina. Do we know what this name means?
I have no idea.
It sounds too much like placenta for my taste. Second, it looks like...
Well, no, this looks like every Indian and also like every South American kind of like almost big four style bike, where it's just got kind of the fairly pedestrian body and some kind of wacky headlight assembly.
I don't have a name for this aesthetic, but there's a new aesthetic that I've noticed. It's most noticeable in the 2023 KTM MotoGP bike. And this bike has it also. It looks like a Mad Max bike went through a stone polisher.
Okay.
I need a name for this aesthetic style, but that's the description of this aesthetic, right? Yeah. Bring up a 2023 KTM and tell me it doesn't look like a Mad Max bike went through a stone polisher. I defy you. I'm going to have to add this picture to the show notes as well, the 2023 KTM.
What kind of bike? What kind of KTM?
The GP bike. The MotoGP bike.
Oh, okay.
It was just with its funky, like, makes-no-sense exhaust coming out the back and a bunch of other weird things about it, like surfaces that seem flat even though they are convex. Bits that you'd think would be covered by bodywork, but inexplicably aren't. It just has no sleekness to it. It's very polished without any sleekness whatsoever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right? Tell me that's not Mad Max going through a stone polisher.
Yeah, that's pretty correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I know you wouldn't normally think the same thing from this to the Placina thing that you're talking about, but...
Platina.
Isn't that what I said?
You said Placina.
Oh, Platina, yeah. Whatever. It's got the patina of cheap all over it, is what it has.
Also, just as a shout, I'm going to put a call out, because there's got to be somebody who can help us out here, because I've always wanted to look more into Indian motorcycle culture.
Oh, yeah.
But it's fucking impossible, because so much of it is in Hindi and isn't easily searchable on the internet in English.
Well, the world's most listened to motorcycle podcast is an Indian podcast. We could look up transcripts of it if we were willing to put in more effort.
There's that. But there's also the fact that the Indian motorcycle brand, and this is all Christopher Columbus's fault. Because if it wasn't for Christopher Columbus, we wouldn't have called the natives here Indians, and then we wouldn't have had the Indian motorcycle brand, which completely ruins any searches for actual Indian subcontinental motorcycles.
It's true. Yeah.
It's impossible. It's so much work to find anything Indian.
Yeah, there's a few things that it's like, was it like the first season of the show, we were trying to look up the bike, like the motorcycle owning history of Nicolas Cage, but it's so hard to Google anything about Nicolas Cage because he's such an internet thing, right? But yeah. You like try to Google anything besides the filmography of Nicolas Cage and you don't just get generic Nicolas Cage-ness in your Google research. There are some things that are so hard to Google because Google works a little too well. Yeah. Anyway, this motorcycle looks like it sucks. It looks like for this price point, yeah, you're going to get better brakes and better like creature features than you used to get in that 100 like 150 sort of range. But it looks like, I'm guessing that this is an engine setup that Bajaj has licensed from someone else. So they had to kind of take the fuel injection and the rest of it is suffering as a result. So whilst it's a great thing for India to have more fuel injection bikes and bikes with some sort of emissions on them, as the average consumer in India, this is so meaningful to our listeners, by the way. you're getting this thing that's got lower performance and lower features just because you're putting less out the tailpipe, which your average consumer doesn't give a fuck about.
Look, for me, disc brakes are a much higher priority than fuel injection.
I agree. But when your bike only weighs 250 pounds and then the rider on top of it is 140 pounds at best, 160 pounds at best. What are you really? The drum brakes are probably fine, but it's not what you're looking for in a brand new motorcycle. Well, they're not going to be made of asbestos or anything. They're going to be like modern compounds that aren't like horrible to get on your hands. It's going to be fine. And honestly, you don't have a weird thing about drum brakes that people don't want to admit. You don't have to change them as much as the pads, as much as you do disc brakes. They're much bigger, meatier pads. And the way that they wear is on like a grade. So it's not until you're actually like, you know, in a place like India that you're actually wearing down to the metal that pad is mounted on that you're actually going to change it. Drum brakes actually, like one of the reasons that you can buy like a Honda CB500 and there's a very good chance the brakes were never changed is like their drum brakes and the way that they wear, they last a really long time. There's a lot of surface to them.
It's true. But it's also like one bolt to change your brake pads on a modern bike.
Oh, you're right. I would much, much, much rather not have to take the fucking wheel out to change my brake pads.
It's like $20 every like 3 years to replace your brakes.
I get it. But, you know, when you're really pinching pennies and you're looking at long-term, like, cost of ownership, like people do in places like India, that's something that people do consider. It's not the biggest deal breaker to have drum brakes instead of disc brakes like it is here. But I also recognize is that this is a culture which is modernizing quickly. And once you get disc brakes, it's hard to go back to drums. But if you've always had drums and you're in a place like India, you can live with it. So I understand why Bajaj is making this motorcycle. But yeah, I wouldn't make that choice. Absolutely. And the bigger implication is as all these manufacturers want to have more and more international models, and as things are being made by Bajaj under different badges that come to the United States, Bajaj is more and more and more going to want to make a model of motorcycle that's for sale in the United States, Canada, Mexico, the UK, whatever.
Well, also,
is it smart to keep doing these things or just saying screw it as an industry? Even in these places, we have to go to disc brakes.
Well, there's another element to this as well, which is, you know, I don't know if anybody else has noticed, but there has been somewhat of an ongoing global supply chain issue.
Yeah.
And
supply chain will give us a quicker death knell on the drum brakes than you would think.
Yeah, because a lot of the industry that's currently in China is all slowly moving over to India, because China is actually, it's not suddenly, it's not surprising.
Weirdly, this is coming back to Christopher Columbus. And we're going to start talking about shipping lanes and currents and trade winds. No, so, it is significantly cheaper to ship shit here from India than from China.
Well, there's that, but also China has a rapidly aging population.
It depends which coast.
Right, if you're coming through the Suez Canal, then yes, it's all about India. But also, India has a much younger population, and a lot of the factories that were originally in China for the Western market are moving to India. And if you're already making for the Western market, you're not going to be making drum brakes for the European market. Like, the European Union is just going to say, why don't you go fuck yourself?
Right.
Like, no, there's hardly any nation in Europe, like in Central and Western Europe, that will accept, like, drum brakes meeting any kind of safety standard. And beyond that is the U.S., and you're probably going to make them in the same factory. So here's the thing.
I think the most significant thing about this bike, and I think there's actually kind of a way to frame this bike as the best bike in the world this week. And what that is like,
as a historical artifact?
No. We are starting to see fuel-injected, you know, something approaching emissions-meeting motorcycles in India. Whereas China seems to be trying to go electric as fast as possible, I think that's a losing game. As far as very, very small, emissions-friendly, gas-powered bikes, maybe we're going to see those out of India. And it's not just going to be this Chinese versus Japanese manufacturers war for the mid to smaller range motorcycles in the United States. It might be, well, do you want your Chinese electric or your Indian gas powered bike?
I mean, for the Japanese or for the Chinese, if they could, they'd be putting NiCad batteries in those bikes.
Right.
It's only because they're selling them to the West that they're putting lithium batteries in.
Right. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, India has no pretense of going like, yeah, we're going to make a shit ton of battery powered bikes. They're like, that's not what, no. They're more about where the rubber really meets the road. Like, what actually gets people from A to B, not what people imagine themselves on. I'll give Indian motorcycles this. There is no pretense to them whatsoever. They are 100% practical forms of transportation.
Oh, they are completely
functional.
That are
100% proven.
They will get
you from A to B. And if they have to be understressed motors, so be it. So be it.
Yeah, they're very when you look at the lower end on the Indian market, from what I've found, like, they are very functional. There's a little bit of fancy.
You can't say their bikes don't work. Now, do they work at the speeds that Americans want them to? No. But do they fucking work? And do they put the miles in? Fuck yes.
That is true. Yeah.
Cannot be contested. It's just, can they scale that up? Now, apparently with Royal Enfield, they have scaled it up to 650 twins. And even your, even, you know, a 650 twin is like buying, you know, like a 1400, you know, 2 liter cruiser here in the US, right? In the UK, in India. So, but I'd have to imagine that even those customers that are buying, you know, those, Royal Enfield 650 twins are expecting a lot of reliability out of those motors. And yeah. Cleveland Moto and a lot of other people were super skeptical about that engine when it came out. That unit construction engine they finally put out, and they're like, I don't know.
That's because they sold below 500s.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, you know, cannot be blamed for being skeptical after that. But I have heard no complaints about this motor. I haven't seen the reviews of people saying that they fall apart. I haven't seen it. And they only seem to keep going with the new 450 Enduro model and everything. Anyway, we're at like over 35 minutes on this worst bike in the world, and I'm really excited to get to our best bike.
I just want to put out one more time. Yeah, so some
final thoughts.
I just want to put out at the end here. If you're an English-speaking Indian and you can come on here and comprehensively talk about the Indian motorcycle culture.
Oh, fuck yes. I will put you above Patreon members.
Yeah, I want to talk to you because it's so hard to find anything about Indian motorcycle culture, and I want to talk to you.
Yes. I 100% agree. Okay, let's get to best bike in the world this week. Here we go. Everyone, hold your breath. And the best bike in the world this week is... It's two bikes at once. It's really the Osa Bira 1000. But I have to talk about the Osa Yankee 500 SS at the same time. Now, three people just jizzed their pants. And the rest of you have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about. So, I've been watching a lot of preseason MotoGP content, and I thought to myself, Spain is so motorcycle obsessed and never really gets the credit for being a huge motorcycle culture like the UK does, like America does, like all over the world. We think of Brits, Americans, and Japanese as being motorcycle obsessed.
Well, and Italians.
And Italians. But, I mean, yeah. Really, the Spanish are just fucking crazy for motorsport.
Which everyone would know if you were following MotoGP.
Yes, if you were following MotoGP, you would be tuned into how obsessed the Spanish are with motorcycles and motorcycle racing. I mean, they, as far as motorcycle sport goes, they might be the predominant culture in motorcycles.
Yes.
Whether we're talking about motocross GP races and enduro stuff and supermoto and definitely Grand Prix motorcycle racing. There are more Grand Prix held in Spain than even in Italy or the United States or UK or whatever.
This is why KTM is making a GasGas team.
You're right. GasGas is a Spanish motorcycle company that is bought by KTM, and now there is even a team just because the name is from Spain. Repsol is Spanish. It's huge. They are absolutely out of their minds for motorcycle racing. So I was looking into motorcycle brands that are from Spain, and I came across this amazing thing. And so there's this company called Osa, O-S-S-A, from Spain. Now, I'm going to warn you. What I'm about to drop on you is going to change a significant thing that you have believed about vintage two-stroke motorcycles. It's going to change it forever. And I don't know what you're going to do with this information. So, in 1972, this company, OSSA, O-S-S-S-O-S-S-A, a Spanish motorcycle company, made a prototype motorcycle and a prototype road legal version of this motorcycle. They raced this motorcycle. Three people ever rode it. One of them died. So this motorcycle has a 30% fatality rate.
Awesome.
This was a 1 liter double down tube frame, 4-cylinder, 2-stroke. I'm going to repeat that. This was double down tube frame, inline 4, air-cooled, 4-cylinder, 1,000cc, 2-stroke, and in final race form made 115 horsepower in 1972. It was raced, it was competitive, and it killed the racer. This is, as far as I'm concerned, Kawasaki 3-cylinder triples, irrelevant. This is the 2-stroke to end them all.
It's more power than anyone.
I have a lot more history and context to give you about how this motorcycle came about, but Swigs, let's just talk about the implications of this thing existing.
Well, I'm just thinking, how do you get that much power to the ground safely with 1970s metallurgical technology, which clearly they didn't?
So it took, so initially apparently it delivered something like 90 horsepower, but over like the year to 2 years that they raced it, they continually improved it, because the race version was 1 of 1. Right. And it still exists. It was crashed to shit, but someone bought it and repaired it, and it is on display in a museum. And I think the road legal version might still be on the road. Only three people ever rode these two motorcycles. The brothers that kind of built the thing and designed it, and the racer that raced it competitively. And one of them died. I'm sure the road legal version exists, but is no longer actually ridden. So apparently something about Spain and their road rules at the time, you could just make a prototype vehicle and just get it titled or something, kind of like you can in the States here. But because they made this bike, it was based on a production frame, and the motor was the OSSA Yankee 500 motor, but just joined in the middle to a common crank. And I'll get into that story in a minute. I think this is legitimate. This qualifies as extremely rare, but also something that we can talk about because it was titled on the road and it was competitively raced for an entire season. So this is not just a weird because you can say, yeah, well, I bet someone has probably made a 3-liter 2-stroke in their garage somewhere, right? But the idea that this is a 1-liter inline 4 2-stroke that was competitively raced is very different. And that makes this the 2-stroke be all and end all. You could think of this as the who's the guy that did the 1 liter V twin, kind of Harley adjacent, the New Zealand guy that, oh my gosh.
The Britain?
Yes, the Britain. This is the two-stroke Britain.
That's, yeah.
That's what this is. This is, it's kind of one-off, but because it was actually raced, it kind of gets that credibility that the Britain, if you're going to take the Britain seriously, you have to take this seriously.
I can't imagine who can responsibly wield 115 horsepower in a four-cylinder two-stroke on the streets. Who can handle the power?
Well, band? Evidently nobody, because the only rider died. This is the ultimate yeah. Widowmaker. This was that we met the limit right here. Also, it is 72. No mag wheels. This is spoked tires. This was, it's hard to get specs on this thing because it's like one of one and a lot of people don't care, but this looks to me like 34 millimeter conventional forks.
Yeah. Okay.
This looks to me like it has very close to CB750 rear shocks. It's a fiberglass body, like just your normal race work sort of stuff. But the frame, I can tell you what the frame is. And this is what we'll get into some of the history. So, in the 1960s, according to Wikipedia, John Taylor of Schenectady, New York, decided to begin building motorcycles. And he wanted to make dual sports. And he wanted them. He was like, well, why are people going to buy them? Because in the early 70s, we're getting a lot of Japanese small displacements that are, 100s, 125s, 175,
right.
Two-stroke, you know, think like the CT175, the S1, yep. You know, those sorts of things. And he's like, well, I want that, but I want to make one that's a little bit sturdier and more powerful. And he gets this Spanish company, OSA, to make a... It's like 488cc two-stroke for him, but it's like a little too much. Yeah, 488. It's a little too much. So he starts with some 250 two-strokes and some other stuff, and the bikes are amazing. Like, as he designs them in the 60s and as it comes together, they're great. The problem is they're selling like 5 to 10 a month. Because they can't get their supply chain going.
Right.
And the whole thing is slowed down for this very, very crucial, like, 5 to 6 year period where the Japanese really get their shit together and start making 252 strokes of a quality that no one can match. But before the Japanese got their 252 stroke quality together, there was this little company by John Taylor of Schenectady, New York, called Yankee Motorcycles, that were making original frames, putting these OSA two-stroke motors into, and they were kick-ass, except they were just immediately overpowered by the mass-producing and dealership network of Japanese companies. So if you can find yourself a Yankee Motor Company two-stroke from back in the day... They're great motorcycles. They made like a 230, a 250, a 225, and then a 500 road bike eventually. So the 480cc road bike, which was the final model that they got together by like 1971, they took two of those motors and put them together with a common crank to make this 1,000cc bike that OSA made. And they called it the OSA Bira. And so the OSA Yankee 500 SS is also sort of best bike in the world this week, because this is a lightweight 250cc American made. This is an American, except for the motor, which is Spanish. This is an American made road bike, 488cc, making 50 horsepower in 1971. I would love to ride this bike.
It sounds ridiculous.
It looks just like a Can-Am two-stroke, except it is completely road-focused. It is amazing. If I saw... in the next, 5 years, we'll see one at Vintage Days, I'm sure. And when we do, I will declare it the best bike at AMA Vintage Days. Again, this in 1971, this is a United States made, except for the motor, 488cc road bike, two-stroke, making 50 horsepower. This is fucking crazy. This is like Yamaha 400, like numbers out of a 500, sure, but like similar weights, horsepower. I mean, this is fucking crazy. And then they made a 1000cc version for prototype racing, right? Is this not the wildest shit you've ever fucking heard in your life?
It's absurd. It's like, this is like the, well, back in the day, this is the equivalent of like the guy who just chopped up and welded two R6 motors together.
Yeah, except you could just buy it.
Right. It's absurd.
If I had one of these, I would restore it. And only ride it on sunny summer Sundays and baby the shit out of it.
Well, you'd have to.
Because
you couldn't ride it to its limit.
I'm sure you could get someone to machine you new heads and pistons and stuff for it. You could ride it and rebuild it and have no problems.
But could you ride it?
Well, the 500cc version I could. The 1000...
It sounds like a terrible. It's like
I bet I could responsibly ride the 1000cc version under 5000 RPM,
like in a straight line.
In a straight line, yeah.
Yeah, this is the equivalent. This is like equivalent levels. This is a step above, like a Z1 RTC in terms of throttle response.
Yes. Yeah, 1000 inline four two-stroke. This thing must have... Oh, my God. Claire is obviously home. Everyone... Yeah, that was the dogs. Anyway. How could you... What could buck... harder at 6,000 to 7,000 RPM than this?
Nothing.
It's
absurd.
Ugh. Have you brought up pictures of it? Have you looked at it? It is.
I looked at some. Yeah.
It's a fairly. What's also crazy about it is it's a fairly nondescript kind of looking bike.
I've seen some pictures that are just like all the just like unpainted stainless steel, and.
As it sits today, it's all black. It's got black fainted fins on the air cooling. I think it's got the original exhaust because the headers look like they've got a little bit of wearing to them. It has a massive 300mm single disc brake on the front, which for 1972 was real impressive braking. It's a two-pot 300mm brake with a lot of shit drilled into it. It's got a lot of spokes too. It's got a lot of custom bodywork. It kind of looks like an Isle of Man TT bike of the time, except it's this crazy inline four two stroke. And the tell me if I'm off base. But the two stroke kind of has like a Kawasaki jug look to it.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It is quite a thing. I mean, we're talking about all the complexity of, you know, the inline four carburetors on a CB750 or a CBX or something, except these are flat slide carbs. Well, no, early CB750s were flat slides, except this is a crazy fucking two-stroke. It's just fucking wild. I have talked about very few motorcycles that would scare the shit out of me. One of them was the CR500. And this is joining that list of motorcycles that would scare the shit out of me to ride. I mean, could I ride one? I mean, you know, give me four beers and yeah, and I'm not going to take it over, and give me a tachometer and I won't take it over 7,000 RPM and sure, I can ride it. But like, to ride it the way it's meant to be ridden, this scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, this is absurd. I love it.
I mean, it's like a ZX6R, except all the power comes within like 1800 RPM.
Yeah, I mean, as much, you could ride a modern H2 and it's fine because it's responsive. It's got fuel injection. It has a modern ECU and it will give you that power linearly. This will not. This is
right. But here's the other crazy thing is that everyone has talked about forever how the H2 is the two-stroke be-all and end-all.
Oh, of the Widowmakers. No, this is, well, clearly by the fatality numbers.
Right.
It's a small sample size.
It's a very small sample
size. But by the numbers.
But by the numbers. But also by the horsepower numbers, right?
Yeah.
And sure, there were MotoGP 500 two-strokes in the 90s that were doing bigger numbers than this, but not at this time? No.
In a dual cradle frame?
At this time, Grand Prix motorcycles were still doing like 220, 240, 250 cc's.
Yeah. At this time, with early 70s brakes and suspension and frames, no.
Well, if you look at this is from like 1972-73. That double pot disc brake, that was the most advanced disc brake on the fucking planet.
Yeah, it's not right enough.
I know it's not enough, but I mean, it was what they got.
Even, yeah, it's not even close.
Those were the biggest forks. That was the biggest brake they could get their fucking hands on. I mean, if you think about it, like if you put this next to like a Pulsemart Ducati, it's not much less brakes and forks.
Yeah,
it was the absolute limit at the time. This was the fucking limit.
Yeah, and I don't know how many of our listeners have actually taken, like, a 60s or 70s bike and completely wrung it out and jammed the brakes on.
Yeah.
And felt how anemic the brakes are.
Even on my CB350, when I put those 34 millimeter slide, did you ever ride the CB350 with the Mikuni slides on it?
I rode it up to 65 miles an hour.
Oh, I took it to 85 once.
I probably didn't have the slides on then because I was wrung out at 65.
Oh yeah, yeah. With the standard carbs, it would just about hit 65. Yeah. Mm. So I put some. So remember when I took the original exhausts and I just ran them straight, just straight pipes, and I put 34 Mikuni slide carbs on it. And I jetted it for our altitude and everything. I set it up as best as you possibly fucking could. And I could get an honest 85 miles an hour out of that thing. But I left it that way for like a month. And I was like, I'm doing damage to this thing. It doesn't have an oil system designed for this kind of RPM. It because there's no RPM limit on that bike. It's just how much air can you suck in? How much can you blow out? So running straight pipes with 34 Mikuni slide carbs on it, I got it to 84, and it would just fucking scream. But you could just, like, instinctually feel like the metal getting eaten away inside the top of the motor. Yeah. And it just felt uncomfortable. Like, it wasn't pleasurable. It was like, this is great to be doing this speed on this kind of bike, but I know that I'm, like, eating history as I'm doing this. Like, it felt... like 20 years ago, did you ever throw a McDonald's bag out your car window? It felt like doing that every 10 seconds.
Right, yeah.
And that was the emotional feeling you got out of it. But this is a machine that's from that time designed to do that.
Well, I think it was a fraction of the magnitude, but I had a similar experience with the W650 putting the washers on the needles, where it's just like, oh, just put these tiny little washers on the needles and the carbs, and it'll get rid of the flat spot, you know.
Yeah, in the dark, we'll see fuel exploding out the back of the exhaust.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, yeah, and it was one of those things like, well, yes, if you're in third gear and you're doing 30 miles an hour, yeah, there's this awful little flat spot that just, like, chugs a little bit. It's like, oh, it's terrible. I've got to get rid of it. And you don't. And then you do it, and then, like... first of all, it made the bike rattle a ridiculous amount.
It did. I rode it before and after this mod. I preferred it unmodded.
Unmodded, it was so much better.
Yeah, yeah. Because who cares about a little bit of a flat spot? Every bike has, that's part of the beauty of an old retro machine. And it was designed to be a retro machine before the big retro craze even came in.
Oh, no. Like, that bike, the motor in that bike.
Before fuel injection, flat spots were just a part of every fucking motorcycle.
Yeah. Well, I believe for the W650, it was exactly, well, it was the same motor, it was the same design. I think the only thing was that it was a new casting, or it was new molds for the casting of the motor. And that was it. It was just, this is a 60s motor with modern machining. And yeah. That was it.
Yeah, and it's a complete, to this day, I mean, we still have it in the family. It is a charming ride.
It is, yeah.
That's the word that I give to it. It is a charming ride. Is it big power? Fuck no. Is it enough power? Yes, but the amount of character in that bike and in that ride is, I mean, if you want a legitimate sort of retro experience, I cannot guide you to anything better than a W650, because you've got modern machining and modern reliability with what really feels like vintage performance.
Yes.
But vintage smooth performance. Like, you don't have to fight the machine.
The only thing you have to do is, because it's a 180 degree crank, is you do have to learn how to relax on the machine. Because if you are a new rider and you grip those handlebars tightly, it will just rattle all the sensation out of your hands. You've got to chill out. You've got to grip it lightly.
It has to be a 180 degree crank because it needs to make, you know, high 30s horsepower so it can claim 50 horsepower on the spec sheets.
Yeah.
It has to be each cylinder boom, 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 boom. It's two dirt bike motors next to each other.
When I say, or sorry, not 180, it's a three. Sorry, it's
360.
It's a 360. No, it's both the cylinders at the same time.
Oh, right. Yeah. Sorry. It needs that to make the torque of a modern bike. Sorry. Yeah. And it's going to make the same horsepower regardless of when they're firing, but how much torque when they do it in conjunction. Yes, yes, yes. But it wouldn't pull away in traffic like a modern bike if it wasn't the 360 crank.
No, it pulls away from a traffic light a little bit better than a modern compact car does.
Wait, no, hold on. No, the 360 is still fire alternating. It's
No, what I'm I can't remember what the order is, but
on a twin, a 360 crank is the equivalent of a crossplane crank on a four cylinder. Sorry, it's not for the torque. It is for the alternating fires, which is what throws off the weight and causes the vibration.
No, it's a rattler because it's basically a double thumper.
Yes.
The cylinders go up and down at the same time.
No. Well, they go up and down at the same time, yes, but their fires are are 180 apart.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Anyway.
The point is they're 180 apart because it's 360. You have to divide in half. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that this bike we're talking about, the Osabira 1000, which the Spanish apparently used to call the Bira Major, the Big Bear, is the be-all and end-all of fucking two-stroke ridiculous fucking road bikes. Forget everything you've heard about Yamaha triples. Forget everything. This is the be-all and end-all. And not only that, if you want... Huh?
I thought the Spanish for bear was Oso.
Maybe it was Oso Major. I thought Bira was Spanish for bear, but I could be wrong.
No, it's Oso.
Oh. Well, then they called it the Oso Major, as in Urser Major.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Anyway, that's what they used to call it. That was like its nickname.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
So, in any case, this is it. Every time someone wants to tell you about how cool their Yamaha triple two-stroke is, we now have the thing to fight back.
Yeah, this is the escalation.
This is the escalation, right? This fundamentally changes the, like, 30% of conversations that happen at vintage bike meets. Because at some point, people used to be able to go, oh, H2. And that ended a conversation that was like, oh, I have an H2 in my garage. Oh, yeah? Did you know there was a two-stroke that was mightier?
Right.
Right? Oh, you think you have the most exclusive crazy thing, right? Because ultimately, because I don't think there really is such a thing as an ultimate motorcycle. You know, an ultimate motorcycle can only be measured in how much you love your motorcycle. So I love it. I never do it, but I love when somebody else shuts somebody down that thinks they have the ultimate motorcycle. And so now, whenever you run into those guys that all have their H2s at the campsite at AMA Vintage Days, you could be like, you know, there's something that far surpasses.
There is another.
Exactly. All right. I think this is a good point to take a little bit of a break. Then we're going to come back with the thing that we teased last week, the unpronounceable motorcycle brands. And I think we have something else on motorcycle, like your senses when you're biking. But let's put in the rev limit and let's see where we get after that. Okay, and we are back. Woo! All right, so hard to pronounce motorcycle names. This is another in the ongoing series of how to sound like you know what you're talking about. This might be the most literal how to sound like you know what you're talking about, because we are talking about the pronunciation of motorcycle brands. This is something that most of you are going to be 90% good on, but all of you are going to hear one of these names that you've been saying wrong. And now you'll know the right way to say it. Okay? And we're gonna give it to you definitively. And yeah. So, I mean, let's just go down some of these alphabetically to start with. Okay. Swigs. I'm going to put you on the spot. What is the, I think it's Ukrainian, Czechoslovakian high performance exhaust brand that people cannot pronounce?
Akrapovich.
Perfect. So Akrapovic. People say Akrapovic. People say British people get the, instead of Akrapovich, they do the Povich. That's a little potato potato. But strictly speaking, it's Akrapovic.
So there is, when you get into Eastern Europe, this is a little bit of a weird thing, but essentially it's weirdly, if it's Ukrainian, just pronounce every single, so every letter phonetically and you'll get there. But weirdly with, a lot of the more Russian kind of Cyrillic names, if you see a C on the end, add an H. And you'll kind of get there. But yeah, that's a little bit a weird kind of quirk of that region. But yeah, they don't really kind of translate it, even though it's actually something that's very similar to like the Chinese translated names.
Right.
But the Cyrillic sounding names, they don't quite translate over quite so well. Unless it's Ukrainian.
Okay. Let's keep moving through here through some of these best ones. Here's another big one that trips some people up. Weirdly, rednecks fucking nail this one, and others trip up on it. Swigs, can you tell me the now subsidiary of KTM, Swedish company known for garden tools like chainsaws and tractors, but now makes things such as the 401 Svartpillen?
Husqvarna.
So, there's two things with this. There's Husqvarna and Husqvarna, but for the general English speaking world, Husqvarna is the way you say it. It's not. The secret to this one, like a lot of these is going to be, is just say it as fast as you can. Husqvarna. Just go through it and you'll get it right. Don't hang up on any of the weird consonant vowel connections. Just go, yeah. Husqvarna.
The best advice is try not to sound it out. Just blitz it.
Yeah, so I think where people really trip up is they try to add a consonant sound between the K and the V, or the Q and the V.
You don't know where the sounds are.
It's not Husqvarna. It's just Husqvarna.
Yeah, but you don't know where the sounds are.
It's not Husqvarna. It's just Husqvarna. That's it. Just Husqvarna. Say it fast. Husqvarna. that. And you can do the Husqvarna, that weird European thing, if you want, but no one gives a shit. Just get the Q and the V as close together as you can, and you'll be saying it correctly.
And if you ever feel clumsy saying these words, just go on YouTube and look at, just search for German people saying squirrel. It's hilarious. It's amazing. It's so much fun.
Okay, here's a tough one. Swigs, Italian front suspension or fork manufacturer, beginning with M.
I don't know what you're talking about, actually.
Marzocchi.
Okay.
This is a weird one. You've got to be a sort of parts nerd, but this is a company that still makes a lot of high-end and mid-range suspension for a lot of race bikes and Italian bikes or European bikes in general. But Marzocchi, it's kind of like, well, some other pronunciations we're going
to
get into.
This would have been so much better if you had just prepared some slides to put on the TV.
Cast this list that I have to the TV. You are correct. Let's do that.
Rather than having this be a quiz.
Well, to be fair, you're up to date on a lot of this stuff. I didn't think that I needed to. But okay. But yeah, Marzocchi. Marzocchi. This is just one of those things that people come across and have decided to disregard. But this is a brand of a lot of repute that you should know about and you should be able to say. These are components still present on a lot of new sport bikes being made today. And this is something to know about. So, Marzocchi. There's a thing with the Z where it's like a TZ sound, Marzocchi, that you can really dig into if you want to say it, but just Marzocchi is going to get you by on pronouncing this one. That's how you say it. Okay, Swigs, now we're getting into the big one. If there is one that people really need to learn to say correctly, it's this one. Walk us through it.
Especially if you're an American, this is the most important one. It is not Moto Guzzi.
It is sure as fuck not.
It is Moto Guzzi.
Here's what you need to know. The double Z, it's like pizza. You have no fucking trouble saying pizza with the double Z.
There you go.
That's it. Like you say pizza, it's Guzzi. That's how you remember it. Think of pizza. It's fucking Italian. The most Italian thing you know how to say correctly is pizza. The double Z is exactly the same as pizza. Instead of pizza, it's Guzzi. That is it. That is the entirety of the trick behind the pronunciation of this, and you no longer have any fucking excuse. Not to mention that this is one of the longest running names of continuous manufacturer under single ownership. This is one of the most prestigious motorcycle brands in all of motorcycling. This is one of the most, the companies with the most unique manufacturing and has such a unique automotive signature to it. You should know this and you should be able to say it properly. You cannot be a motorcycle nerd and not be into Moto Guzzi. It's like Jeremy Clarkson once said, you can't be a petrol head and not be into Alfa Romeo. You cannot be a motorcycle nerd and not be into Moto Guzzi. It's the Italian Harley Davidson. It's a thing of beauty. It's a thing of prestige. You need to be able to say this. Moto Guzzi. It's not hard. If you say it 10 times, it doesn't even sound foreign that much anymore. Right?
Well, yeah. Because at this point, pizza doesn't sound foreign, and you should figure this out.
Yep. All right. This next one's interesting. You think you know BMW, but you don't actually know BMW. You know BMW, but BMW motorcycles is actually called BMW Motorrad.
Motorrad.
That's what I said, wasn't it?
Motorrad.
Yeah, Motorrad. Yeah. So, BMW Motorrad. It can trip you up, just so you know, it's Motorrad. There's a double R in there that trips people up. It's just a thing that you need to know. That's what the company's actually called. All right, Swigs, this next one. This one's not that important to know, but it's just a thing that comes up in motorsports. And I don't think this place is as important as people think it is.
It's not. I mean, it's really... It's been cinematically and television-wise, it's been very important because it's kind of had this modern thing around it. It's not super culturally significant, but yeah. And it is not... Well, the important thing is that it is not Nürburgring... It is Nürburgring.
Yeah, it's not Nur and it's not new. It's Nürburgring. Yeah, I can't give you an easy way. You just need to know it's Nürburgring, and that's how you say it. But you know, it's going to come up on documentaries. It's going to come up on weird YouTube videos. It's going to come up when you talk about whatever. Okay. Next one, much more important. This is like, Marzocchi. This is a real big performance front suspension company.
I didn't think this one was okay. So, one thing
I've heard people say Allens. I've heard people say Allens. I've heard people say like all kinds of dumb shit for this one.
Really?
Yeah.
Because this is the most, this is the easiest one.
The umlauts trip people up. They make people think that it's got more flair to it than it should have.
So, what, people... I thought this, if I had picked any European name that I would have thought that everyone, like 100, like 99% would have aced, I would have picked Ohlins.
You know, sport bike guys nail Ohlins, dirt bike guys do not.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I would have thought-
Harley Davidson people have no fucking clue.
Really?
Yeah.
This is the this is like
I know
preschool of
I'm just European telling you
pronunciations.
That the
this
umlauts,
is so straightforward.
The umlauts on the O trip people up because the umlauts that people say because here's the thing, Americans have no idea what umlauts do, right? So. They look at that and they don't know any other way to pronounce an uppercase O rather than to just say O. So they nail the umlauts and the O, but then they think that the umlauts on the O means that something later on should be pronounced something differently. So they usually fuck up on the I or the S.
I will say a lot of people do look at like, all the accents on characters in European languages, and it's always like, I've got to pronounce this in a weird way. I've got to go off base.
Yeah, so I'm just going to take a big swing. Right? Yeah. So it's just, you just pronounce it like you think you should. Ohlins.
Yeah, it's not hard.
Yeah, with Ohlins, just relax. It's Olin's. That's it. That's it. Stop trying so hard. It's just Olin's. Let's keep going down the list here. What's a really good one that we should go with? Let's do some of these Chinese ones. Okay. So this one I think people do very well with. But just to give people a little extra confidence with some of these Chinese names. Just so you know, Zongshen is Zongshen. If you really want to be better with it, there's a little bit of a D in the front, so it's more like Zongshen. So like
Zongshen.
Yeah, like think of it as a double Z almost. Zongshen will get you 80% of there, but it's really more like Zongshen.
Right. But you know what? I will say
And that's so subtle, I cannot fault anyone for getting it wrong.
But you know, it's also on this level of, you know what? You, as an American, you are allowed to say omelet as to the perfect.
Oh, l'omelet.
You can say omelet and you don't have to match the perfect French pronunciation of omelet. We are allowed to regionalize words and names to some degree.
This is true. Yeah, I have a lot of flexibility in these. I just want people to know the exact way, since we're covering this in such detail.
Right, yeah. You should also understand that also there are like 12 or more different dialects of Chinese, and China is actually unified by a written language more than a spoken language.
Okay, but this is a Chinese one up here, though, that legitimately fucks people up.
Oh, Chenjiang?
Chenjiang.
Okay, yeah.
So this is Qianjiang. This is a name that you're going to see pop up more and more and more. This is so when people talk about QJ Motors, this is the company. And a lot of people, and I have been very guilty of calling it Qianjiang forever. It's actually Qianjiang.
It's redneck as fuck.
I'm just saying I have been guilty and I am not beyond reproach here. I have called it Qianjiang and it is Qianjiang. It starts with a Q. I know. It looks totally phonetic. It is not. It is Qianjiang. Qian/Jiang. This is a place in China. This is non-disputable. It's Qianjiang. It's not a matter of like, well, you pronounce it from where you're from or no, this is a thing. But QJ Motors is Qianjiang. If you really want to sound like you know what you're talking about. This is one that's sort of important right now and is going to become more and more and more important over the next 20 years, or you're going to sound like a fucking idiot. That, just letting you know. Let's see, what else have we got here? Here, let's go to this one. Do 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 do. Swigs. Italian, vintage Italian. This is where I go back to quizzing you on stuff until I get this brought up on the big screen. Vintage Italian brand that doesn't exist anymore. Due for a legacy fraud comeback, I argue. That specialized in aeronautics.
Oh. Aramaki?
Got it. Air Machi. It's not Aeromachi. It's not Aeromachi. There's no O in it at any point. It's A-E-R. And then where you think there's going to be an O, it just goes to the M. It's just Aeromachi. And that's really it. I don't know why people say this one wrong. I don't know where this gets fucked up in people's minds. I think this is one of those ones where it starts so oddly. They think that they have to pronounce the end of it weird as well.
Because it's exotic.
I guess so. But it's just Aeromachi, right?
I will tell you. Most of the mispronunciations I have heard of all of these words come from dealership salesmen.
You're right. Untrained salesmen fuck this shit up a lot for people.
And it really just should be like, it should just be, there should just be a, like, in the same way that, like, Wendy's and McDonald's have had, like, educational video, like, training videos for their salesmen, these videos should exist for motorcycle dealerships. I don't know why they don't.
Okay, Swigs, the parent company of Vespa. How do we say this?
Piaggio.
Now, this is one where we want to say, don't always be thrown off by the Italian double letters. In Piaggio, P-I-A-G-G-I-O, just treat it like one G. Piaggio. That's it. You can say Pia and you could say Gio. Piaggio. It's not anything to get tripped up over.
And these are not complicated things. These are actually like phonetic tricks that you will learn in the first hour of any language course.
Yes. But we don't expect people to take the first hour of, like, 15 different European language courses.
That's fair. Yeah.
Okay, so on that one, this is a very easy one. I want to remind everybody that there's only one L in Aprilia. I hear a lot of people, again, they think it should be pronounced more exotic than it is. And they want to say Aprilia. And it's like, no, it's just Aprilia. It just go straight ahead. A lot of these things, if you're ever, this is your like sort of catch-all trick. If you're ever in trouble with pronouncing these names, just try to say it as fast as you can.
Again, just imagine an old Italian Italian lady berating you and waving her hands around and no word is more than two or three syllables. It's a brutal assault, and it's very succinct and to the point. There's no elaborate words. It's all very condensed.
Okay, this is one that's really odd. I know that I say bimota a lot. It is technically bimota. Bimota. Technically. Because it's a portmanteau. It is the first two letters of the last names of the three founders. So it is actually Bimota. Bimota. You can say Bimota, it's fine. Just know in the back of your head, it's actually Bimota. Just very small thing. Let's see. I think Kajiva is one that people get right pretty often because there's just kind of no other way to say it.
Yeah, there's no other way to say it that sounds good.
So people know Ducati. I'm just going through. It's not Gilera. It's Gilera. That's another good one. Italjet, I think a lot of people get.
I will say I do say Gilera a lot.
Right. It's technically Gilera.
That's a hard one.
Here's a tough one. The parent company of Lambretta. Innocenti. I-N-N-O-C-E-N-T-I. Innocenti. That's a tougher one. I don't know. You just gotta get that. Lambretta, there's kind of no other way to say Lambretta. I've never heard someone mispronounce Lambretta or Laverta, for that matter of fact. Envy Augusta, I think people have a pretty good hand on. I think they've got a good hand on Moda Marini. Morbidelli was tough for people, but I think Morbidelli now being a GP racer has made that a lot easier for people.
Yeah.
As we go down this list, I think we're doing pretty good for those. Let's go into another couple ones. One that wasn't on this list, Swigs. Big sponsor of Valentino Rossi of leather motorcycle goods and helmets.
No, the helmets are different from the leathers.
Yeah, no. Well, but the leather goods.
The leather goods is Dainese.
Well, is it Dainese or Dainese?
The important thing is that it's not Dainese.
Right. I think it's just Dainese.
Yes.
Like Dai Katana. It's Dainese.
What a reference.
Timely. So timely.
No, his helmets are
Oh, you're right. The helmet his helmet sponsor was
No, the helmets are Jesus Christ. Why am I blanking on this?
You're right.
It is like the pinnacle of over
AGV.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was, I'm trying to...
No, it was AGV, which is another ridiculous overpriced helmet brand. Yeah. It's AGV. But, yeah, you're right. Dainese. Just Dainese. 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 Don't, it's another one that you want to add another consonant sound in between the A and the V. Don't. Just, it's not Dainese. It's just Dainese.
No,
huh?
There's no V in it.
Oh,
I mean,
between the A and the N. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Because the last one had a V in it. Just Dainese. It sounds hard to say until you say it. Dainese. That's how you say it.
And again, if you're not sure about any of these names, just try and say them as quickly as you can.
It will almost always set you free. Or at the very least, you're going to say it fast enough that the person you're talking to that also doesn't know how to say it will just be like, oh, that sounds so legitimate.
Yeah.
Right? Again, this is how to sound like you know what you're talking about. The most literal edition ever. Okay. Let's get into some other ones here. I don't have too many left. So, European, where are they from? Okay. European, sports and predominantly motorsports clothing company beginning with a K.
Are you
four letters?
You talking about Climb?
Talking about Climb. It's not Klim. It's not Clum. It's not anything else. It's Climb. Say Climb like you would like say like mountain climbing. Just Climb. That's it. It seems weird. It seems easy to get caught up on. It's just Climb. Imagine the I has umlauts on it, if that helps you. It won't actually if you know what umlauts do, but if you pronounce it the way that people think that umlauts affect letters, just say Climb. It is a hard I.
Rossi is AGV helmets these days.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what's the really fancy brand of helmets?
There's a lot of them.
This is now just my, well, this is just my own personal curiosity now.
It's entirely possible he had a lot of helmet sponsors before AGV. I just know from like 2014 on, it was all AGV helmets.
Okay. I'm trying to think, what's the really fancy brand? Well, just keep going on your script here.
We don't have too many left, actually. I've kind of like gone down the list of ones that I wrote down. Do you have any others that are hard to pronounce that you hear people get wrong a lot?
I mean,
we've gone 25 plus minutes on hard to pronounce motorcycle names. That kind of sounds like enough for me.
I think we're doing pretty good.
Okay, do we want to call this an end at about an hour and 40, or do we want to go a little bit longer? What do you think?
Let's make fools of ourselves and go a little bit further.
Okay. All right. I only have one other topic for this. And I don't know where this is going to go. This might be really good. This might be really bad. I was looking into the psychology of riding and what people enjoy about riding. And I came across this really odd fact that's really obvious when you think about it, but is kind of profound when you really look at it on its face value of the definition. There is no such thing as a sensation of speed. There's a sensation of acceleration. Your body naturally understands that you're moving through space at an accelerating rate. But once you are up to a speed and you're maintaining that speed, it doesn't matter if you're going 1,000 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour. The speed itself gives you no sensation. Now, you get context clues through the vibration of your motorcycle, the vibration of the engine. You get context clues through the exaggerated effects of the road. You get clues through the speed, the wind against your skin. The sensation of speed itself is not a thing. And this has interesting implications. So let's think of a touring motorcycle with a full fairing meant to block as much wind as possible. This is kind of how Harley-Davidson gets away with making 80 horsepower, 90 horsepower motorcycles.
With a short fairing.
Yeah, right, and
it's like,
and
oh, it feels so amazing. All this experience was like, we're just going 65 miles an hour,
right?
Yeah,
and this is at the heart of why they say, well, it's more fun to ride a slow bike fast than a fast bike slow, because let's say you're going 70 miles an hour. If you're on a 1 liter sport bike, well, you're doing relatively low RPM. You've got these great big forks with a lot of travel in them. Well, not a lot of travel, but like it's a lot of suspension that's meant to take the weight of the bike under hard braking circumstances.
Well, a lot of travel for a street bike.
A lot of travel for a street bike, but it's stiff suspension that's meant to take a lot of weight under hard conditions. So when you're just kind of doing 70 across flat ground, you're just kind of floating there. Nothing's really happening. You're not feeling the effects of the road. The engine's not working that hard because it's a motor that produces a lot of torque. You've got the same wind as you would have on other bikes, but otherwise it's kind of dull, right? Whereas if you're on a little 250 or 125 two stroke or something, the engine's going, you know, and it's really going. And so that noise of the engine is giving you a context clue that you're going faster.
Right.
The bumps in the road, you're probably feeling a little bit more because the smaller bike like that usually has lesser suspension. So you're feeling the road more, which is giving you more of a context clue that you're going fast. The physical RPM of the engine is producing more vibration, and it's making a higher pitch sound, and that is letting you know that you're going fast. And then you've got, on top of that, just like I said, the same wind as you would out of, so everything is heightened except for the wind versus a 1 liter bike. Thus, you feel like you're going faster, right? The only thing the 1 liter bike has is torque. So when you do crack the throttle and decide to go from 70 to 90 miles an hour, you're going to have a greater sense of acceleration for those bumps, but you'll have an overall lower sense of speed. And this is why higher displacement bikes have a higher accident rate. Because adrenaline junkies are looking for not a sensation of speed, which isn't a real thing. It's something you can only infer from context clues.
They're looking for acceleration.
They're looking for a sense of acceleration, which only a big bike can really deliver in those huge buckets. And when you're always chasing a sense of acceleration, it's like being a drug addict. You're always just going to be chasing more and more and more. So if you're just chasing a sense of speed, you can actually become satisfied with that. You put all the context clues together and you sort of, you know, build an experience for yourself. And you can be content with that. But when you're chasing a sense of acceleration, if you're not in some very controlled racing environment, you're going to end up dead.
And you can also experience this on the other end, which is you'll be going on a big road trip and you'll be going across the Midwest. You'll be doing it at 75 miles an hour, and you'll hold 75 to 80 miles an hour for a couple hours. You'll do 100 miles, and now just doing 100 miles an hour just becomes your resting state.
Right. Now, this is what I wanted to build to, and you've beat me to it. I was going to say that I'm going to argue that sense of speed does exist, but we need to rename it. Actually, we need to call it something more like condition of speed. So you're cruising along at 60, 70, 100 miles an hour, and you just kind of hold there for 45 minutes or longer. Why is it that people never just dump their bike over at 75 miles an hour in a straight line? But you're doing 75 miles an hour for an hour and a half down a state road, and then you come to a stop sign, and then people do fall over.
Well, there's a couple things. One is the gyroscopic effect.
Right, you've been relying on it. But I argue that adjusting your body to relying on that is part of your sensation of speed. Overall condition that you have conditioned yourself to, literally conditioned is part of having that gyroscopic effect, is just part of your natural world.
Well, they both
it has
come
become
on,
part of your gravity.
Well, they both come on at the same time. I mean, you could just have the exact same gyroscopic effect with slow speed maneuvers if you just revved your engine up. When you were in first gear, you could have the exact same thing. And but it's that they both come out at the same time. But when you slow down, you have two things going. One is you are conditioned to having the same effect as when you're going fast. And two is that you don't realize that you could rev the motor up and do clutch control to have the same gyroscopic effect in first gear.
Yes.
So ultimately, it's a skill issue.
It is a skill issue, but I think it's more an awareness issue, which is a skill issue.
Yeah, it's the first step of a skill issue.
This is true. You need to be aware of it before you can control it. Yes. So again, instead of sensation of speed, I want people to think of sensation of, you know, acceleration. And I want you to think, instead of sensation of speed, I want you to think of condition of speed.
I think a better term would awareness of speed.
Same thing. Yeah. Be aware of your condition of speed. Actually, I think is the way to say it. Because when you're on, let's say, a 250 twin, and you go down the interstate at 65 miles an hour, your condition of speed is going to be very similar to your condition of speed going at 95 to 120 miles an hour on a big 1 liter four stroke. Think about this. We've all experienced this. We're going down the road and we're used to a certain amount of wind and a certain amount of vibration. You get off the bike at a gas station and you didn't notice that your vision was weird when you were going down the road, but you stop and you go, I can see everything so much more clearly.
Yeah.
Because you had become conditioned to a certain level of speed. And it has nothing to do with miles per hour.
This is also why. So also, this is just a little thing.
Because that vibration in your vision would have been the same at 65 on a 250 or 120 on a big inline four, because the inline four was vibrating less.
So also, this is maybe you've come across this before, but when somebody on a motorcycle pulls into a gas station and you say, oh, hey, nice bike or something, when they've pulled up to the pump and they're looking around and they're trying to find you, it's the reason why they can't actually find you is because of the fact that because they've been going down the highway at, you know, 80 miles an hour, their vision has been fully pulled.
Yeah, tunneled.
Has been completely tunneled to their vision. And once they pull their helmet off, they still have that tunnel vision. And they actually have no peripheral vision whatsoever.
Right.
And they actually, when you say something to them and try and call to them, like, it's actually hard for them to, like, look around and find the person that just said a nice bike or because
they
clue.
Have probably been responsibly target fixating on the end of the road at their field of vision.
Yeah. And they've been doing it for like 2 hours,
and they were doing exactly what they needed to do to be safe. But in the space of 15 seconds, they slowed down and pulled into a gas station. And now the way they've conditioned themselves to look for 2 hours doesn't make any sense for their new environments.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, kind of like, I wonder, does it make sense if you've been riding for more than 45 minutes straight to do an extra loop of any parking lot or gas station you pull into before you stop?
Well,
does it make sense to intentionally overshoot your gas station and pull around and just force yourself to come back more into the real world?
If you're at like, I mean, if you're going through like College Station, or if you're like on straight up just a gas station that just serves the interstate and you've got another 200 miles to go, I would say no. But if you're doing like 500 miles and then you've got like another 100 miles to go off highway to get to where you're going, at the transition point, I think you should probably just like have a little bit of a zen moment and just say like, I understand where I came from. I understand what I was doing. And I understand now I'm going to consciously think about the fact that the roads I'm now going to be doing are 30 miles an hour slower, and I need to be more cognizant of intersections and stop signs, and I need to...
Yeah, transitions. Transitions are what we're talking about, yeah. Well, but again, this is why people come in off the highway and just dump their bikes at gas pumps or dump their bikes at stop signs.
What,
yeah. Like, are these like big, you know, high risk situations? No, but they could cost a couple thousand dollars of repair.
They can,
and it's super embarrassing.
I mean, one thing I will say is that I ignore most yellow speed limit signs.
Yeah,
if it says like 45 miles an hour or 35 miles an hour, I just say like whatever.
But well, if those are designed for cars and other things. They don't directly
well, they
apply,
are,
but yeah.
But one thing I will say is that if I do see a yellow speed limit sign that says 25 miles an hour, all the other ones I don't give a fuck about. But if a yellow speed limit sign says 25 miles an hour, I pay attention. Because 25 miles an hour means I actually really fucking mean it. Like, these are like, the road is going to slope up 30 degrees and it's going to be like a 50-foot U-turn. And you need to be paying attention to make this.
Maybe not a U-turn, but at least an L-turn, yeah.
Like, it's,
the, yeah.
20, the- yeah, 30 miles an hour, 35, 45, don't give a shit. If it says 25, 25 is, no, seriously, pay attention.
Right. But I'm just saying, like, so this idea of your condition of speed has nothing to do with a mile per hour. It has to do with a level of just speed sensation that you've become conditioned to. And when you transfer into a different zone, I've not heard the MSF say anything about this. I've not heard of a training course that talks about, hey, you've just conditioned yourself long term to be in this one traffic situation and you have to make a rapid change to another. How do you deal with that? This is a big blind spot in motorcycle safety education.
Well, probably is in the U.S., but I actually got the speech on this when I got my driver's license in the U.K.
Oh, okay.
They actually very much talk about the fact that, hey, you've been going on national speed limit, and now you're coming into a town, and you need to be aware of the fact that your brain has been tunnel visioned looking down the road and you need
okay.
to
so I
be
got,
aware of that.
I got three sentences about this in the MSF and I got maybe four in when I, you know, took driver's ed in high school. But no one gave me a device or a strategy or a context to really put it in to help me change my condition going into that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I was saying, if you're getting off the highway and it's been a long time, is it a bad idea to just, if there's like a Walmart off of that, if it's like, okay, we have gone 2.5 hours on the highway at 70 miles an hour. If there's a Walmart off of that highway exit, is it a bad idea to just do a lap or two laps of that Walmart parking lot before you ride through Chicago. I think it's a pretty good idea.
I think
it's a minute and a half to stop you from potentially T-boning a car.
So I would say yes. And I actually, so here's a thing that has happened to me on three occasions, all in Austin, which is I do 1,000 miles on a motorcycle from Denver to Austin, and in the process, every on-ramp, every time I pull away from a gas station, I get into fifth gear as quick as I can, fifth or sixth gear, and sit in that gear for hundreds of miles until I get to the next gas station. And then, you know, roll a dice, first or second gear, pull into the actual bay,
right,
fill the tank, then put it back in.
Sometimes fourth gear, and it's like, whoa, click, 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 click.
Yeah. And then when we get into Austin, all of a sudden, I'm trying to pull away from a red light in fourth gear.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I do it like 5 times in a row until we finally get to the campsite.
Uh-huh.
There probably is, like, yeah, in those kinds of distances, like, it's not even about the sensation of speed, but it's about the muscle memory. How do you reorient the muscle memory to, like, well, not ride like a fucking idiot?
Another name
for
muscle memory is conditioning.
Right, yeah.
That's why I keep saying condition of speed, not speed sensation. You need to think of your condition of speed. And sensation of speed, you need to think of sensation of acceleration, because that's real. The rest is just context clues. And you can have the same conditioning at two different speeds because they're two very different bikes. And condition of speed is what people need to think of. Therefore, what besides, so I like the idea of, okay, you've done 2 hours on the interstate. It's hard to find an American interstate exit that doesn't have some big parking lot you can't do a couple laps of.
Right.
What else could we say? Is it, I mean, you can obviously just decide, okay, we're coming off the interstate. You know, even before you hit a gas station, is there a place to pull off? I don't know. We can talk about hitting more rest areas. I don't know. I haven't put a super amount of thought into this rather than the distinction needs to be made.
I would think that.
Or is it enough just to be aware of it?
I think it's good to be aware of it, and it's good to be aware of it all the time. This should just be something that's in your knowledge base, but also, when you're getting to your destination, it may be good to just circle the pumps, like, under clutch control and just reorient yourself. Just do one or two laps.
Under clutch control is good because otherwise it's tempting to just let the engine go in first gear and you're still not really reevaluating yourself.
Well, And it can be under clutch control in second gear. In fact, it may be better to do it under clutch control in second or third gear, but just to be aware that you should probably just be at the lower end of the RPM, like, band of each gear.
Well, and enough time that as you're circling the pumps, you can extend each leg out one at a time. Because if we're all honest, we've had those moments where we've been riding long enough. You pull up to the step, to the pump, and your legs almost don't work. They almost don't come out before you have to stop. We've all had a close call with that. Be honest with yourself. You have almost fallen over on your side at the gas pump. And those of you that have been riding for 30 years have definitely done it. It's weird, a lot of the times you get away without any damage to the bike because the bike just falls on you. But with hot exhaust and other things, that's not a great scene. It's embarrassing. It's weird.
Well, the big problem is when, like, you think... The biggest problem is when you think the ground is an inch closer than it is, and you put your leg out and it's not locked, and then it buckles because you didn't have your leg tensed for it, because you didn't think... You thought the ground was going to be coming so much closer, and then it turns into that very, very awkward, like, 10-second fall.
Yep. It's odd. It's weird. You don't want to do it. You don't want to be part of it. It's just...
And it's just like, oh, no, I... fuck it. Yeah, it's
I think my big thing is whenever you find those transition moments, I think we need to find a spot to, as much as you can, don't try to immediately stop. Try to ramp down the riding that you're doing. Even if it's just 2 minutes, I think it can do a lot for us. So...
Well, I think it's just very important to just to be like, it should just be whenever you take an off ramp and you're thinking, I've got to piss, I'm tired, I want to stand up and I want to stretch and I want to just get all this out of me and I want to get a drink of water. And these are all the things that you're thinking like when you hit an off ramp on the highway. But the first thing you should be thinking is, I'm going from averaging 80 miles an hour to now I'm going to drop to 45 to take the off ramp. And now I'm going to go to 10 miles and then I'm going to pull up precisely against the pump. And this is
or a shop window.
Yeah. And this is a big perspective shift. And to be cognizant of that so that you don't do something really fucking stupid, like drop your bike after doing 400 miles. Like,
yeah,
just you just need to have that focus to realize that, like, hey, I'm going from like warp speed down to like navigating a parking lot and I need to not look like a fucking idiot.
It's also something that'll happen without you knowing it. When you make that transition too quickly and you fuck it up, this is one of those Harley Davidson, like, oh, I have to layer down kind of things. It's like, you're going to come up with some sort of excuse of whatever. The ultimate example I give is when I took the MSF class and there was that dude that was like, oh yeah, I came to a stop but the camber of the road was weird, so I put it... It's like, I don't know, dude, how many people stopped their Harley Davidsons at that stop sign and didn't fall over? like
how many Harleys did you find at the bottom of the ravine?
Exactly. Was this a problem with the road or was this your problem? Right? You'll find yourself coming up with some idiotic reason to justify why. You'll be like, oh, my ankle was hurt. Oh, that leg had been bothering me all day. Ooh, I touched the exhaust for a split second and it fucked me up. Oh, I was going to come, but like, I saw my reflection in the mirror of the shop window and it made me feel weird. Or, oh, you were pulling up in the parking spot next to me and I didn't want to get too close to you and da da da. You'll come up with some reason why you dropped the bike. It's most likely your senses were fucked up.
Yeah, it's not like you and I can both come up with a few examples of of us making near catastrophic misjudgments.
Oh, yeah.
Of speed, of balance, of all sorts of things. Like, good motorcyclists make mistakes.
Yep.
And you have misjudgments. And that's normal. And in fact, I kind of have more of a problem than Peter because I make misjudgments and then I overcorrect and I'm overcautious. And this is also the reason why I have still not crashed my dirt bike at this point.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've crashed more street bikes than me, though.
That's true. Well, one of them wasn't my fault.
I crash dirt bikes as a matter of principle. I have to well, come off the bike every time we go.
You treat dirt bikes like skiing.
I do.
If you're not crashing, you're not learning.
Yeah, that is exactly how I think. It's a bike designed to be crashed. I take full advantage of it. The worst thing you could do is fuck up your handlebars. That's really it.
And get a concussion, but
I look at damage to the bike worse than damage to myself, which is not a healthy way to look at it. But anyway, we're well past 2 hours here, so we could let this one end. But yeah, your condition at your speed is something to pay attention to and to try to remind yourself of. And when you hit an exit and you are sort of, think of it as decompression. When you go from highway speeds to a gas station, you are giving your senses the bends.
Yeah, it's
either, and you need to do something to decompress.
And honestly, the best thing that I would say to you is when you're going past that 45 mile an hour speed limit sign, like on the exit off of a 75 mile an hour highway, what you should do, and this is what I do, is you should look at where that sign meets the ground and stare at it as it goes past. And that gives you a little bit of a perspective shift because you're used to going past all of the highway like stripes between the lanes, and they're all like 10 to 12 feet long, and in your vision they look like they're like 3 feet long
or two, yeah, shorter, yeah.
But just looking at the ground and seeing how quickly the ground passes by you,
yeah,
gives you a perspective shift that unless there's a car in front of you, which will do the job all the same, but you should look at something on the ground that gives you that perspective shift to see how quickly the ground is passing underneath you that puts you back into, here's a city driving perspective. Here, let's recalibrate.
That can help a lot, yeah. I mean, just paying a lot more attention to your speedo and your tachometer than you did for the last hour and a half helps, too. But I really like the idea of pulling into a Best Buy, a Walmart, a big box, whatever the biggest parking lot is.
Or just a 12-pump gas station.
Yeah, and just doing a big circle of that before you actually bring your bike to a stop, I think can do a lot. It's like, how much time does it really take? Almost nothing. And it's a little bit of a decompression, and it's a little bit of, you know.
Well, once you're doing a circle of the gas station, like, I mean, what's your risk reduction at that point? It's probably not a lot.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you pull right off the highway, and then you go into a big open area that is a Walmart parking lot.
Mm. Well, I think
that's more valuable than circling the pump.
I would say that's very valuable if you're close, like if you're at the edge of town and you're off the highway and you're not immediately stopping, that's probably really good. Like at the end of your destination, if you're close to your destination, I think that's probably pretty good.
If it's been over 4 hours, I say do it regardless of what you're doing. if it's been over 4 hours of riding that day and you're at your motel, circle the fucking motel. Because that's when you're most likely to drop your bike.
Yeah, to agree. Yeah, okay. That's close, yeah.
Just enough time that while you're sort of cruising, like the bike's just idling and you're going down, you can stretch each leg out, extend your knee, and then put it back on the peg. You can remind yourself what your speeds are. You can kind of slowly squeeze the brake and let them off and just recalibrate yourself to the normal speeds.
Every time you pull off the highway, just remember all the ways that you can embarrass yourself.
Right. And like, especially if you're pulling off the highway.
Shameful, inept things that you can do and be cognizant of it and give yourself every chance to not fuck up.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. All right. I think we need to end this episode.
Yep.
I think this has been a good one. I think we have covered everything we need to cover. And let's hit the outro. You ready?
Let's do it.
And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. Cold.